you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Kevin Barrett back on the show. Of course, Dr. Barrett is a PhD Arabist Islamologist who has taught at colleges and universities in San Francisco, Paris, and Wisconsin. He's also the host of Truth Jihad Radio and the co-host. Are you still the co-host of False Flag Weekly?
Yeah. I'm kind of holding down the fort at False Flag Weekly News.
Okay.
And various people join me every week.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And of course, you translated Laurent Gounod's book. Is that how you pronounce that name? Gounod?
Yeah. Laurent Gounod.
Gounod, okay.
Book is From Yahweh to Zion.
Yeah, that's right. I actually have that in my Kindle. I'm planning to read that. Okay. Well, you recently penned an article. I guess you were reviewing a book, it's Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s by Tom O'Neill. And I guess you provided your insights on that incident in the 60s and what it all meant and what it means today. So I'll let you take it from there. Charles Manson, the Tate-LaBianca murders in the 60s and beyond. So what do you have to say?
Well, you know, I really enjoyed that book. It's not very often when there's a mainstream bestseller that really outdoes the marginalized conspiracy stuff. And it's kind of amazing that Tom O'Neill managed to get this book published, but he really deserved to get a mainstream publisher because he put a couple of decades of work into it. He was originally just going to do something for the 30th anniversary of the Manson murders, and he figured he could try to find some new angle, and he quickly found that the new angle was that all sorts of things about the official Vincent Bugliosi version didn't add up. So he dug deeper and deeper and deeper and got deeper into that rabbit hole. And by the time he finally published the book, he realized that in all likelihood, Charles Manson was Jolly West's CIA mind control slave, and that the Manson murders were staged in order to discredit the left, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and the counterculture such as it was. And of course, that I used to think that was the craziest conspiracy theory I'd ever heard. I mean, I know a lot of conspiracy theories are true, but then there are some that sound pretty crazy. And, you know, Charlie Manson was a CIA mind control slave. Discredit the hippie movement, man. You know, you heard this is from, you know, dope smoking hippies back in the day, and they didn't usually have their facts straight that much. But, you know, I heard these rumors before, but I never really thought that hard evidence would support it. But here, Tom O'Neill, a very good mainstream journalist, writes a mainstream bestseller showing that that's the case. So what does that tell us? Well, it tells us we're living in a false reality. We're living in a matrix. And, you know, if you want to know what's really going on, you better take that red pill and recognize that the CIA can stage a fake murder by a fake hippie manufactured by a mind control expert, Dr. Jolly West, and convince the whole country that the hippies are scary, scary mass murderers, and we'd better go back in a more conservative direction so they can change history with that kind of operation. And similar kinds of criminal, psychopathic, behind-the-scenes deep state operatives have repeatedly manipulated history with these kinds of high-profile operations, from ranging from the Kennedy assassinations to 9/11. So I guess that's the lesson. And the other lesson is never think that any conspiracy theory that says the government's doing something incredibly evil and crazy is too evil and crazy for them to really have done. There's no conspiracy theory that might not actually be true.
I mean, obviously, we do have precedent for this sort of strategy of tension, if you will, manipulating an event, promoting a certain narrative for political reasons. And that seems to be part of the story with the Manson case, at least, with, you know, Bugliosi's Helter Skelter narrative, which was, the official story. That's what he was. I guess he was charged as the guru or the sort of the leader of this cult, and he somehow mind controlled these people to go out and commit these murders. The connection. Obviously, you have Operation Gladio in Europe. The idea of staging events, right? Staging these attacks, carrying out actual attacks, and perhaps even faking some. You know, or just reporting things in the media to create a narrative. This is the function of mass media. And how, well, we all know how the mainstream media with Operation Mockingbird, how, you know, it's closely linked, if not controlled, by the Central Intelligence Agency and the powers that the agency works for. What is it about the Bugliosi narrative that has convinced that's not the true story?
Well, the Bugliosi motive is really bizarre. I mean, Bugliosi claims that Manson brainwashed all of these kids to become killers, and they went and killed the people at the Sharon Tate house and the LaBianca house because they were trying to blame it on black people, and especially the Black Panthers and other radical African Americans, in order to start a race war. And Charlie Manson supposedly believed, according to Bugliosi, that the Beatles song Helter Skelter was secretly about this race war. So Charlie Manson was a racist. That's true. And this race war stuff probably was in the background of his thought. But the idea that that's what these murders were really all about never really held up. That's the thing that Tom O'Neill saw through first when he was sent to write something up for the 30th anniversary. He scratched beneath the surface, and nobody believed this ridiculous tale that this crazy hippie would brainwash all these people and they would, you know, fall for him and follow his orders and kill all these people kind of randomly, purely to try to start a race war. Because the Beatles were telling him to do it subliminally in the song Helter Skelter. I mean, that's the stupidest motive. And so O'Neill quickly saw there was obviously a lot more to it than that. He saw that there were all kinds of other things at play, that the house may have been targeted by criminals, professional drug dealers with links to the CIA and to organized crime. There might have been a drug deal gone wrong kind of aspect to it, perhaps. There were all sorts of other things going on that made it obvious that this helter-skelter motive, that it was all about starting a race war, was complete insanity and nonsense. And in fact, you know, there's a parallel here with 9/11 in that we're told that evil Osama bin Laden, the bearded heavy, like Charlie Manson, his beard is part of the iconography of evil. Mm-hmm. But this Bin Laden was so irrational that he imagined that somehow creating a huge terrorist attack within the United States would somehow defeat the United States in the Muslim world, and it would cause the United States to stop killing people in the Muslim world and to withdraw. Now, obviously, anybody who's taken military strategy 101 knows that that's not the case. The opposite would be the case, that a big terror attack within the United States would obviously push the United States even deeper against the Muslim world and mobilize American public opinion to allow the enemies of Islam, namely the neoconservative Zionists, to take America to war against Islam. And that's not what anybody would strategically want from the anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist Muslim side. And take it from me, because I am an anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist Muslim. And I would cheer for most of what Bin Laden said along those lines, that the U.S. and the Zionists should get the hell out of the Muslim world. Of course they should, right? But nobody would be stupid enough to blow up buildings, murder 3,000 Americans, and imagine that that would somehow help their cause. On the contrary, obviously it would hurt their cause, therefore obviously somebody on the other side did it. And likewise, Charlie Manson, we're told, was so ridiculously irrational and stupid that he would think that killing a few random people in Hollywood would somehow start a race war. These people who stage these events to manipulate public opinion don't seem to have a very high opinion of the intelligence of the general public that they're manipulating, because they think that everybody's going to just accept, oh, yeah, sure, some crazy hippie wanted to start a race war. Oh, yeah, sure, some crazy Muslim thought that somehow blowing up a couple of buildings, killing 3,000 people in the United States would somehow help his cause. You know, nope, but you know, it's true, though, I guess. They're right. Maybe we are that stupid. But if you send Tom O'Neill or anybody else with a three-digit IQ out there to take a look at it, and he takes 5 seconds and he says, no, it couldn't happen this way. I don't know what happened, but it didn't happen this way.
Or a few moments or years to reflect upon it.
Yeah, it didn't take him that long, though. I mean, that's why he ended up spending 20 years, was he spent 20 minutes and said, "This something's really wrong here. This official story is ridiculous. But what the heck the truth could be, I don't know." And he spent 20 years trying to figure it out.
Yeah, a galvanizing and catalyzing event, as they say.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, you mentioned Gladio earlier, and there's a very strong parallel between Gladio in Europe and Manson in the United States. In both cases, they were discrediting the left. The people in power at that time tended to be quote unquote right wing in that, you know, at that time, this was prior to the neoliberal revolution, which actually emerged out of Gladio and out of the Manson operation. But back at this time, there was this big move towards the left all over the world. And not only was the Soviet Union and the communist world the big enemy, but the people who represented big money, for the most part, were afraid that the left wing was going to continue to succeed at redistributing the wealth and building a really strong, big middle class that would never give up its prerogatives and would gradually keep wearing away at the power and wealth of the elite. And so they were constantly staging things, trying to blame the left in order to swing public opinion against the left and create a right-wing, pro-capitalist, sort of Reagan neoliberal revolution, which is precisely what they did. And they did that by demonizing the left. In Gladio, they staged bombings and massacres and blamed it on left-wing terrorists. And in the United States, among other things, they created Charlie Manson. They took some idiot, racist, borderline psychopathic nobody from a prison and went into the prison, and Jolly West went into the prison and brainwashed Charlie Manson and brought him out. And Jolly West set up right there in an office at the corner of Haight and Ashbury, practically. And Charlie Manson set up right next door, and Jolly West taught Charlie Manson how to do drug-induced hypnosis and brainwashing. And Charlie brainwashed a bunch of 14, 15, 16-year-old runaways to basically follow his orders in the same way that Jolly West brainwashed Charlie Manson to follow his orders. So the CIA brainwasher Jolly West actually taught Charles Manson how to brainwash people. And of course, at the same time, Manson himself was brainwashed. And that's where the whole Helter Skelter thing came from, because Jolly West, originally the CIA was going to use Manson, among other things, to screw with the Black Panthers. And so what they wanted to do was create a big fight between hippies and Black Panthers, or stage one. And the way to do that was to create a fake, bunch of hippies, namely the Manson family, and turn them against the Black Panthers. And Charlie Manson was perfect for this because he was just this two-bit trailer trash racist from prison. And so it was easy to brainwash him into hating black people and to, you know, spouting that kind of rhetoric. And so that's really the fertile soil from which grew this ridiculous poisoned fruit of the Helter Skelter motive.
Now, MK Ultra is a broadly understood as sort of a mind control program, but it's much more than that. It's more ambitious. In fact, that might be a misdirection because although psychological manipulation, drugs, drug-induced hallucinations or manipulation is a part of it, it's also a broader cultural programming agenda. I mean, others have done research on this. In the 1950s, Life magazine, I think it was in May 1957 cover, where they were promoting hallucinogenic drugs. And this actual article was traced back to a sub-project of MKUltra. And so here you have the manipulation of the media. I think this was Gordon Wasson who was doing this. And he was a part of, I think he was a head of PR for J.P. Morgan, but he's also working with the CIA. And with that type of relationship, you'll see this sort of this, confluence, or so we say, milieu of banking, public, news media, publications, entertainment. And you don't necessarily have direct connections, but all these same people overlap and they all kind of know each other and they coordinate, whether it's the type of movies they make or the type of news stories they promote, creating narratives. And much of the 1960s, people have researched this, that much of the 1960s, the Vietnam War, and you touched on this in your article, sort of the tumult was sort of planned. It was decided that you needed the trauma of these events. The counterculture needed the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War fed the counterculture. The music created the soundtrack, and you created the upheaval of the 1960s, which led us into the disillusionment of the 1970s. Understanding, what's your idea of MKUltra, and how does it relate to, you know, something like the Manson cult and the scene out in Hollywood? Because you talk about in the article is this sort of a community of gangsters, CIA agents, movie producers, musicians. To me, that's kind of like MKUltra in a nutshell.
Well, yes and no. I mean, MKUltra technically was the name of the most heavily funded CIA program of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And its goal was to create a Manchurian candidate, that is, an unknowing assassin. That was how they would know that their program had succeeded, if they could take any ordinary person and program them to kill someone without knowing why they did it, or perhaps without even knowing that they did it. So that's what MKUltra was. And it was one of a number of CIA mind control projects. There was also Project Monarch and various others. But MKUltra was kind of the big umbrella term, I believe. And as for the relationship between MKUltra and the 60s counterculture, they weren't exactly the same thing, but there was a very tight relationship because the CIA was using LSD and other hallucinogens, but mainly LSD, in its brainwashing experiments. And it farmed out a lot of its experiments to college professors. And among the various college professors that were involved in this, of course, there was Tim Leary. There were a bunch of people at Stanford who turned on Ken Kesey, that is, fed Ken Kesey LSD in mm-hmm. experiments there. And so a lot of college students were given LSD as part of these experiments. But the LSD had a lot of interesting effects. It wasn't just a mind control tool. That's how the CIA saw it. That's how they were interested in it. But some of these people, I think, kind of went out of control. People like Ken Kesey and Tim Leary, although they were linked to the CIA and were taking CIA money, I believe may have had agendas that were quite different from those of the men in the gray flannel suits who had originally set up these programs. And so there was a lot of actual chaos. It wasn't all totally planned. But I do think that once the LSD got out there and it was, you know, changing the culture in various ways, contributing to various changes, some positive and some negative. On the positive side, it does seem that Timothy Leary's claims over the years that they had a Washington Wives Club where wives of very powerful men in Washington, D.C. were giving their husbands LSD in an effort to usher in world peace. That's probably true. It seems that Mary Meyer,
yes,
the wife of Cord Meyer, was the real prize of the Washington Wives Club because she became JFK's kind of the love of his life, or at least number two after Jackie. I guess they would have been in a rivalry to see who was number one, who was number two. In any case, JFK had a very intense affair with her, and
they went way back. They went way back to the college years, didn't they?
Yeah, they dated in college, yeah. And then they didn't see each other for a while. And then after he was president, the relationship really heated up and got super hot in 62 and especially 63. And she was, you know, smoking pot with him and then dropping acid with him right up through the summer of 1963. And it seems quite likely that that had everything to do with JFK's famous quote-unquote turn towards peace, where in June of 1963, he gave that famous American University speech, I think it was, where he essentially laid out a roadmap to total disarmament, starting with nuclear test ban and moving on to banning nuclear weapons. And his final goal was complete disarmament. The Russians were very interested because the Russians were way behind in the arms race. They had spent the 1950s building empty silos to be decoy missile silos so the U.S. would think they had a lot of nuclear missiles. They actually only had a handful of nuclear missiles that might or might not have even worked. And in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened at a time when the vast majority of the top U.S. military people wanted a nuclear war with the Russians. They estimated that they might lose as many as 40 million Americans, hopefully quite a bit less, but that the Russia would be totally destroyed and we would win while we still could. And if we didn't fight that war then, when it came, it would utterly destroy the United States. So they just wanted to fight World War III now. That's what the Cuban Missile Crisis was really about. JFK refused, and in so doing, single-handedly saved at least probably 15, 20 million, if not more, American lives and hundreds of millions of lives worldwide. So that's the backdrop. And that LSD that Mary Meyer fed to JFK might very well have been a key factor in preventing the, you know, this murderous war, killing hundreds of millions of people. So I would say that's kind of a positive on the positive side of the ledger of this LSD coming into the culture. And of course, Mary Meyer, her husband, Cord Meyer, was the head of Operation Mockingbird, the CIA's mind control, media mind control program. That is, Cord Meyer placed people in media, he bribed people, he bought people, and infiltrated the media and controlled the media on behalf of the CIA. He was given an award for that program, which was viewed as the CIA's all-time most successful program, its media control program. So that's what Cord Meyer was doing. His wife, Mary Meyer, turned into it. Well, they were both originally peacenicks, and Cord Meyer was corrupted, and Mary Meyer remained a peacenick, had that affair with JFK, fed him marijuana and LSD, and probably had a lot to do with turning him into a rabid peacenik, which had a lot to do with why JFK was killed. And then Mary Meyer herself was assassinated by the same people who killed JFK. She was murdered as she was jogging on the towpath in Washington, D.C. And there's a great book out there about this. I'm trying to remember the name of the author who knew Mary Meyer, Peter Jenny, I think it was.
Yeah.
Mary's Mosaic is the name of the book. Mm-hmm. So that's all great stuff. And so that shows us that just to a certain extent, the way LSD was operating in the culture was it was triggering miniature mystical experiences in various people. In some cases, they were kind of hellish. You know, some people basically got a vision of hell and others a vision of heaven. There was good and bad that came out of all of that. But I think the CIA, which viewed LSD purely as a mind control tool, they never really quite understood what the heck was going on as Mary Meyer was turning JFK towards peace. And they thought that pushing drugs into the counterculture could mess with the political edge and stop the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. That was their goal. They thought the left was moving too fast in the 60s. They wanted to slow it down and stop it and screw it up. And especially they were afraid of the black liberation movement. So they pumped all kinds of drugs into the left-wing political movement. And I think LSD was probably one of the less damaging ones. Speed in particular arrived in huge quantities in Haight-Ashbury after that summer of love of 1967, and suddenly everything turned ugly. And in this book on Manson by Tom O'Neill, he doesn't quite come out and say it, but he speculates that the CIA intentionally flooded the hippie scene and the left-wing scene with speed because they had done experiments showing that they could get rats to rip each other apart and eat each other up by pumping them up with amphetamines. And so I think they did intentionally push these kinds of really damaging drugs like amphetamines, PCP, oh my goodness, and what were some of the other ones? The downers and quaaludes and heroin and all that kind of stuff, these kind of body drugs that that make people stupid and aggressive and nasty. And they're kind of, you know, they take people away from the kinds of mystical experiences that ultimately, ideally, people should be having without drugs.
Yeah.
And then some people only get those from something like LSD or peyote or magic mushrooms. But that's, you know, that it's not a real good idea to mess with that because you should probably be prepared if you're going to have a mystical experience. Anyway, the CIA flooded that whole milieu with drugs and did that intentionally to try to screw up the left-wing political movement at the time.
Well, yeah, the vectors they used for this were a lot of the rock festivals that were sort of these Dionysian rock festivals. And, of course, certain musical groups like the Grateful Dead became a way to promote LSD use. I think it was their touring manager was the son of one of the founders of the Tavistock Institute.
Yeah. There are all of those connections. And there's a wonderful book out there by Dave McGowan called Weird Seeds Inside mm-hmm. the Canyon that I highly recommend. Anybody who's interested in this Charlie Manson case and this sort of CIA messes with the hippies thing really needs to read Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon by the late, great Dave McGowan, which covers some similar territory, but it's very complementary with O'Neill's book. You know, if you really want to understand just how twisted things were in the 60s in L.A. with that organized crime movie star pop music scene, read those two books, and that's really probably more than you really need to know.
Well, and also the CIA, if it's carrying out, I mean, if it's trying to, I mean, we know from the work of Gary Webb, but the CIA was involved with the 1980s with cocaine, shipping cocaine into the country, and this involves both the Bushes and the Clintons. It's bipartisan, but ultimately crack cocaine, and there's some evidence even crack cocaine was created by, you know, professors out in California, and it was then distributed in the 1970s. It wasn't something that was invented in the 80s, but they knew what it would do. The CIA in furtherance of this program wouldn't have CIA agents do this. They'd have assets do this, and what they consider assets would be certain gangsters or cults or gangs that can to kind of do the dirty work, do the on the ground, while this agency itself keeps an arm or a couple arms length away from it. And we see a lot of evidence with, of course, something like why it's tantalizing to look at the Manson cult and say, well, there's a lot, you know, if you look at MKUltra and what they've done with other cults, of course, the CIA's use of cults is well documented. There's even, you know, look at the, you know, the one in 78, you know.
Jonestown?
Jonestown, yeah. And how that has all the makings of some sort of CIA experiment. And there's, of course, there's a cleanup afterwards with the assassination of Moscone and Harvey Milk. And Harvey Milk appears to have been collateral damage in that. But Moscone was linked to Jones. You know, Jones himself was a power broker in San Francisco politics. And he had some inexplicable connections to politics, you know, to the political establishment there. He got the vote out and things like that. But when his operation was cleaned up in 78, that's when he did the assassinations by that guy, White, who claimed the Twinkie defense. A former cop or something.
Yeah.
So it just a strange whole thing was strange. But my point is though that if you look at an area like L.A. or Hollywood, people usually associate the mob with New York, or Chicago, maybe even Kansas City, but really Los Angeles and Hollywood is really all mobbed up. In fact, some of the biggest moguls out there, you know, like Lou Wasserman, came from the Chicago mob.
Yeah, that's right. And people who aren't aware of that might want to check out the article that Ron Unz published a while back, not very long ago, I think, on the Chicago mob moving out to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And they apparently took over the West Coast by setting up the Japanese people to be interned in concentration camps during World War II and then grab the property of these Japanese internees. Apparently, the Japanese had done very well in the U.S. They started coming over towards the beginning of the 20th century. And by World War II, they built up quite a lot of really valuable property, including some of the best agricultural land in the state. And so when World War II broke out, or the U.S. got into World War II by way of the Pearl Harbor orchestrated war trigger event, suddenly these gangsters from Chicago and their friends in politics in California bribed various folks, and then they bribed people in Washington to push through the Internment Act, and they got the Japanese interned, and they grabbed the property. Mm-hmm. So Chicago ethnically Jewish mobsters were able to build this super mob, which is, I think, the name of the book that talked about Wasserman and these other West Coast power brokers, Mickey Cohen and so on. That whole power nexus, which was behind Ronald Reagan, among other people, grew out of the ethnically Jewish Chicago mob robbing Japanese Americans of this huge pile of property by getting them interned in concentration camps. So that's a World War II concentration camp story in which the Jews are not playing the role of the victims.
And nor have they been asked to pay any compensation to the victims, have they?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? You kind of think that the West Coast Mafia, with its billions of dollars, should be paying some reparations to Japanese Americans. But I think if anybody introduces that bill in Congress, they might get Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, that's the power structure out in California, because there was these various Jewish gangsters that first set up, I think it was Brown, then Reagan, the dynasties there, the Brown dynasty, yeah. And the Reagan. Of course, his path to power was through Lou Wasserman and Music Corporation of America. And what happened was that when the war ended, they had to sell off all this property that had been seized, and it sold off. And there was this guy in the Truman administration that they had installed to give it to all their buddies. And most of them were a member of a certain tribe.
Yeah, yeah. And that story is told in Ron Unz's piece, American Pravda, The Power of Organized Crime. Mm-hmm. Which is highly recommended. People can go to unz.com, that's UNZ.com, and click on Ron Unz's personal rubric. And I think it's maybe his second most recent article.
And he, what was the judge? What was it? The youngest federal appeals court judge that was given a job? He was like 40. And he was the one that engineered the transfer of the property. I forget his name.
Yeah, and he had no experience, right? This guy just made some schmuck judge in order to do that.
And Truman, of course, was a bagman for the Pendergast machine. And, people don't realize how mobbed up the system is, how close the organized crime is to politics, and vice versa. I think Ron Unz and Argon made the observation that this guy became a radical civil libertarian.
Yeah, right. He kind of covered his tracks. And a lot of them do that. And Unz, in the article, suggests that
these
great civil libertarians like Alan Dershowitz, the great civil libertarian who also is the strongest voice arguing for legalizing torture, and who happens to be Jeffrey Epstein's personal attorney, who was implicated in Epstein's crimes against minors, is, he wears his liberalism as a kind of a mask to hide the fact that he's an extreme authoritarian psychopath. And he probably would be more at home in the political right, but then that would be closer to exposing who he really is. So mm-hmm. he adopts this left-wing mask and makes you wonder how many people on the political left, or who pretend to be part of the political left and the civil libertarians and people like that, are really just reactive in using that as a way to hide their real natures.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about sort of this the narrative that came out of the Manson murders, the Tate LaBianca murders, was this sort of a way of slandering or discrediting the left, the hippie movement, in the eyes of the American public. They're all crazy. They're coming to get you. You better, embrace the state to us to protect you. Shift the politics, the strategy of tension. And in that Ron Unz article, he suggests that part of the reason why these oligarchs who stole all this property became civil libertarians or liberal in the 60s might not have been just been guilt. It had been a strategy to create a situation where there is sort of chaos and problems on the street. Where you're worried, if you're worried about street crime, your attention isn't going to be towards the political elite or the oligarchs who are robbing the state and the country blind. And he cites, you know, sort of the decline of the middle class, the concentration of wealth, the explosion in indebtedness. And this is all part of a huge, you know, scam to pretty much rob society by using the political process. And that's what he suggests, that maybe perhaps this is why, you know, they support civil liberty, so to speak, so they can promote the discord and at the same time promoting policies which creates chaos in society. If you're worried about being mugged on the street, you're not worried about what the oligarchs are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the old definition of a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged, mm-hmm. or, you know, then some say mugged by reality. Well, I don't know about reality. I think it's more like somebody who votes for or tolerates neoconservatives is a liberal who's been mugged because these same neoconservatives and their friends have set up the situation to mm-hmm. get you mugged. And as you say, yeah, these people profit on chaos. And ultimately, that quote from that guy who was prosecuted during Operation Gladio, who, you know, in the courtroom, he explained that you had to attack innocent women and children. I think it was Vincente Vinciguerra or something.
Yeah, Vinciguerra.
Yeah, he said you had to attack innocent people, women, children, people far removed from any political game, and the purpose was to make people turn to the state for their protection. And all of this stuff has that effect. All of this fear creation, however you want to create fear, whether it's by having, you know, allowing or encouraging or making the Japanese attack you at Pearl Harbor, whether it's staging political assassinations, whether it's, you know, setting up crazy hippies like Charlie Manson and scaring people about hippies, whether it's creating violence around the Black Panthers so you can scare people about the Black Panthers, whether it's through actually creating more crime, you know, pushing civil libertarianism so far and other similar policies so far that it creates lots of street crime, and then everybody again has to turn to the authoritarian statists for protection. And so that is the oldest trick in the book. And likewise, I think chaos does promote a certain kind of political, not just paranoia, but a kind of political paralysis. I think that when they got Charlie Manson and set him up as the bogeyman of the left-wing hippie movement, that wasn't only to smear the hippie movement by making Manson the public face of that movement, although that was a big part of it. But I think also that the whole chaos of that operation, and of course the CIA domestic COINTELPRO operation was called Operation Chaos. COINTELPRO itself was an FBI program, mm-hmm. but Chaos was the parallel CIA program about which virtually nothing is known because it never got exposed. They never turned over their files. And so creating chaos, I think, discourages people. And you know, to some extent, I sympathize with some of the people who hate conspiracy theories, and they don't want to hear the kinds of things I say. And in some cases, what they say is that, you know, Kevin, if you talk about all this stuff, it's so discouraging to see, you know, how power really works and these extreme examples of these horrific crimes that they've gotten away with impunity. You know, if we talk about that, ordinary folks that we're trying to motivate to get into political action to make things better may very well throw up their hands and shrug and turn away from politics. And I actually can see that. I think there may be some truth to that. And so when some of these activists that are more in the mainstream tell me that, you know, I can't say they're 100% wrong, but I do think that they at least should notice that I'm not the one who is flogging conspiracy theories in order to induce political paralysis and discourage people from participation. It's the people who created the conspiracies who are doing that, and they're doing it intentionally. They know that when they stage these outrageous crimes, that the situation it creates is one in which the very few people who are brave enough to talk about it get marginalized, and then the broad masses of people they have a very tough choice. Are they really going to take that red pill and face how awful it all is? And can they still actually get excited about voting for the lesser evil or going out and working on making their neighborhood better or joining a movement to try to, you know, enforce transparency on the government or the internet or what have you, any of these idealistic political projects, which deserve people's support, may not benefit from the effect of people learning about these horrific crimes of the deep state. And I think the deep state commits these crimes in part for this purpose, precisely to create a situation where ordinary people cannot mobilize to take back the power from these deep state elites. And those of us who are exposing the crimes of the deep state elites should think about how we can talk about these things without totally discouraging ordinary people and convincing them to just crawl back into their shells. Because I see this pattern all the time. You know, somebody wakes up to the fact that the 9/11 official story is a big lie, and they get really excited, and they see how obvious this is, how, you know, 2 minutes of looking at Building 7 related material, and you know this for sure.
And so, they ruin Thanksgiving.
Yeah, they ruin Thanksgiving. So that person will go out and do activism, and they'll get all excited and ruin Thanksgiving for their family and all of that. And that goes on for a week or a month or maybe a year, but they burn out, and because they see that so many the ordinary people can't handle this, and that this whole dynamic was created by the people who committed these crimes in the first place, in part because they know that that's the effect of these crimes. And so at some point, I guess, you know, we have to both keep challenging the criminals on their and standing up against those crimes, but also, you know, talk to the general public in a sympathetic way with some humor and with some humanity, and try, you know, not to be just discouraging them, try to be in fact encouraging them, find some discourse that can actually motivate people rather than paralyze them.
Yeah, it's, you don't want to be like Kevin McCarthy at the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Right.
Yeah. And you have to look at these things in their broader historical context and deeper understanding. I mean, you just take a deep breath, reflect upon it, and think, and maybe perhaps read some more before you start preaching, which is always good advice in anything. What you're talking about is sort of this induced trauma, and this is, I mean, the people, the deep state operatives that do this, they're relying on decades, if not centuries, of sort of a scientific study of human psychology, mass psychology. And this is what the function of something the Tavistock Institute was established for in the wake of the First World War, where they studied, you know, shell shock and the trauma, the effect it had on the nervous system and the human psyche. And of course, this, I think John Rawlings Rees was the one who opened it up in the 20s in Britain, but it was study not for the purpose of curing, but for weaponizing it and for applying it to the broader society. May not be in the context of a shooting war, but maybe in induced trauma, fear, culture shock, constant changes, and you induce society with this, you do create that paralysis, and there's never a calm moment for a clear thought to reflect upon these things. And that's the function of war. That's why, you know, war propaganda, looking back at it, seems so absurd, but at the time it's very effective. But the same thing with economic shocks, various shock doctrines, and
Naomi Klein's book goes into that, and, you know, just dances around 9/11, which is the ultimate example of it.
And you can create economic shocks. A good example was the energy crisis of the 1970s was created for a certain geopolitical and also cultural reasons. It was Henry Kissinger and the petrodollar and these things. And also it was a part of his plan to impoverish and miserate and starve a certain percentage of the population in the third world to put less pressure on resources. That was his National Security Study Memorandum 200, which some say that he wrote when he was on LSD. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
But, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, but I'm not, you know, but the whole point is that if you want, this is the secretary, I don't know if he was Secretary of State or National Security Advisor at the time. I think he might have been Secretary of State at the time. But anyway, he more or less admits to this plan of sort of reducing a population in the developing of third world, retarding or stopping development through the oil shocks, and that was a big part of them retarding development of the third world, and then in their eyes freeing up the resources for their use, and they didn't want the third world developing. At the same time, in the 1970s, you had the church had this applied domestically. In the 1970s, it was revealed that the and this is how it functions. You had the, I think it was the department under Sergeant Shriver, the Department of Department of Economic Opportunity, and some of their block grants gave almost $1 million to this group in Chicago. It was a black gang called the Blackstone Rangers, and it was designed to chase, I think, it disperse a Polish, ethnic Polish neighbor out of the city, and this was, you know, push them into the suburbs, create white flight, just to create mayhem so they would leave. And this is all, you know, part of supposedly one of these Great Society uplift programs. So these programs are weaponized. But then nevertheless, it shows how malevolent these government institutions, even ones supposedly benevolent, like welfare agencies, are utilized by those in power to achieve some sort of economic or social or cultural agenda. Catherine Austin Fitz has talked about how she phrases it this way. She says, whenever mothers get together to chase out the drug dealers, to chase Tony Soprano out of the neighborhood, they find they got to deal with James Bond. You know, because it's the backing, ultimately, the drug trade has the backing of the intelligence agencies. And of course, Doug Valentine has written so much about this, about how these relations between the intelligence agencies and the drug trade, and how it relates to drug enforcement. And drug enforcement really is very selective. It's, you know, it's all about protecting one cartel versus another at any given time, for some other, for geopolitical economic reason. But nothing is as it seems. That's the bottom line here, isn't it?
Indeed. And that Kissinger strategy of preventing development in the third world is maybe something we should be thinking about today, because the U.S. may be pivoting and changing its China policy in the direction of going all out to try to slow Chinese development, because China is becoming such an obvious medium-term, if not even short-term, geostrategic threat.
Isn't that funny?
To surpass the U.S.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing the beginnings of a kind of a battle between the China hawks and the normal policymakers around Trump. And it's a very dangerous moment. Moon of Alabama just blogged something about this. I wrote something about this in an article I submitted to Crescent Magazine a week and a half ago. And I just had to update it a little bit because, you know, this on-again, off-again trade war with China is heading in a direction that could possibly lead to, you know, an actual U.S. preemptive war on China. Although, of course, the U.S. would prefer that it appear that China starts the war. And the situation right now is such that if we move towards decoupling, and that's kind of the, you know, that term is now coming into use. It was unimaginable in the past that the U.S. could economically decouple from China, because everything we buy at Walmart is made in China. And, you know, so you'd think it would take a long time to do that. And really, it's not even possible. But people around Trump, Peter Navarro and these China hawks, are actually talking about that. And there are some strategists who are saying that if China invades Hong Kong and puts down these color revolution protests the CIA is helping stoke in Hong Kong, if that happens, and it may happen after October 1st, because that's the anniversary of the Chinese Revolution. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese may make that kind of their deadline. If the Hong Kong authorities can't get Hong Kong pacified by October 1st, China may move in. And if China moves into Hong Kong, then Taiwan is going to go bananas, because the, you know, Taiwanese anti-China people will start yelling and screaming, you know, we're next. And there, you know, Trump is now selling fighter jets to Taiwan. This hasn't happened for 40 years, I believe, maybe 50 years. So things are really heating up there. And if, you know, China and Taiwan is the obvious flashpoint. Like, you know, when U.S. has a security guarantee with Taiwan, if China invades Taiwan, the U.S. is required by this agreement to defend Taiwan. And so that would be a way to start a war. And yet such a war couldn't really happen until the U.S. is decoupled economically from China. And that's what they're talking about. And, you know, Trump's hard line in the so-called trade war could be moving towards that kind of decoupling, which could set the stage for what really would be, whoever we're told fired the first shot, you know, it's what it really would be a U.S. preemptive war to try to stop the rise of China before it gets out of control. And that's how all major wars seem to begin. It's always the same story. The number one power sees a number two power that's rising too fast. You know, it tries to ally with the number three power to stop the number two power, and things may or may not spin out of control, and it may or may not become a big war. And this is called the Thucydides trap. There's a book along these lines, and I think that Harvard University has an institute devoted to studying this Thucydides trap issue with relation to the book about the Thucydides trap, which came out a couple of years ago. Graham Allison, I think, is the guy who wrote that. It's called Destined for War. Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? And this slowdown growth thing that Kissinger was talking about with regard to the Third World is even more strategically significant today regarding China, because China has been growing double digits for a couple of decades. It's slowed a little bit below double digits right now, but it's still growing vastly faster than the U.S. or the West. And that puts it on a course to become the world's most powerful nation within a decade or so. And typically, number one powers don't allow or don't want to allow number two powers to do that. And so how the U.S. chooses to deal with the rise of China and with its own decline, clearly the U.S. is in pretty serious cultural and intellectual and financial and technological and moral decline. Yeah. And so how the U.S. deals with this situation is going to determine whether we and our children inherit a nuclear wasteland, which could, you know, and that could be happening sooner rather than later if we don't watch out. I mean, this China thing is, it could come to a head pretty fast. So I think that, and then also the Kashmir situation with India and Pakistan, just a hair away from nuclear war, the combination of these two things over in the most populated part of Asia is very, very dangerous. You know, we're entering dangerous times. It's getting to look a little bit like the 1930s all over again, or some would say the pre-World War I period all over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, worrying about emerging China, same way the British Empire is worrying about emerging Germany and Russia, too. It's interesting because China itself was set up to be this economic powerhouse largely by the West and the Trilateral Commission. The Rockefellers in the 1970s, of course, this involved the closing of the Bretton Woods, you know, the gold window, collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the rise of the petrodollar, which led to the deindustrialization and the financialization of the U.S. economy, but also the growth of the export of industry to China in the 1980s and 90s that we're seeing today. And this is all, I mean, now this could be, you know, now they're getting out of control. And so they got to be reined in a little bit, or, you know, they're becoming a threat. But so much for trying to run the world, right? So.
Yeah, well, part of it, I think, is the model. You know, part of it is that China's model involves having its elites, its financial elites, a little bit restrained. You know, their banking system is 80% publicly owned. Their Communist Party keeps their billionaire oligarchs in line to a certain extent. Just as Putin has kept his oligarchs in line to a certain extent.
They occasionally shoot them.
Yeah. And here in the U.S., we don't allow anybody to keep our oligarchs in line because our oligarchs just run everything. You know, our system is this neoliberal system where the oligarchs can buy up the national police and the armed forces and the political power. And of course, our oligarchs are overwhelmingly Jewish and Zionist.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps 40-50% of our billionaires and our millionaires are of that persuasion. So we have a very strongly, you know, pro-Israel oligarchy that totally runs the country. And this is something that I think if ordinary Americans knew this, they would be rather upset. And I think the Chinese model is one that I think these oligarchs don't want to accept, because, you know, if the Chinese can use public banking and a system where there's a Communist Party bureaucracy that is has the final say, and the oligarchs can't just buy anything they want with their money, that's not good enough for them. And so that's one of the major contributing factors to why they have to have this big, you know, clash of civilizations war with China. For the same reason, I think, that they had to have their clash of civilizations war with Islam, because in Islam, lending an interest is considered the worst possible sin. Riba, it's called. Usury is what the Christians used to call it back when they had a prohibition against it. And Muslims still have that in their Quran and still believe it. And so anytime you allow Muslims to have the power over their own country and sovereignty, they're likely to move away from this neoliberal capitalist model that allows for unrestrained usury. And that also would provide that'd be an even worse restraint on the capitalist usurious elites than China's Communist Party is. And so this so-called clash of civilizations, it isn't really a clash between people who like hamburgers in America and people who eat with chopsticks in China and people who like falafel in the Middle East. You know, it isn't about culture. It isn't even so much about the metaphysics, where the Americans are either, you know, post-Christian, you know, sort of secularist, materialist atheists, and the Chinese are sort of between communist atheists and still, you know, sort of Confucians at heart. And the Muslims are by and large still pretty religious in their culture in terms of being monotheistic. It's not really even about that, I think. What it's really about is that the kind of political system that emerges out of Chinese neo-Confucian Marxism and Islam, either one is going to put major restraints on these neoliberal capitalist elites, and they don't want restraints. They want to stay in charge, and so that's if they smash these restraints, then they don't have a problem with these other countries. Then, as far as they're concerned, these other countries are great. They would be happy to move their operations to a so-called Muslim country or to China, as long as they don't have any restraints and they can just buy anything they want and they're in charge of everything. And likewise, if the United States ever decided to get its elites under control and we stopped being this neoliberal capitalist paradise or hellhole or whatever it is, then they would flee here and they would go someplace else where they can do any damn thing they want. So that's really what I think it's about.
Like you're talking about a particular group.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm talking about the super rich, and those super rich, you know, there are certain ways of grouping those super rich. And when I talked about the Jewish Zionist element, wouldn't you have 40% plus of the billionaires who have that kind of strong tribal feeling? Boy, that's going to be a very powerful group.
Well, they manage to maintain their cohesion in the midst of chaos, which is why they like to sow chaos, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. That order out of chaos thing, and you know, some people say it's Hegelian, but yeah, Michael Jones thinks he calls it the Jewish revolutionary spirit. I think there's a little bit of Hegel and a little bit of Jewish revolutionary spirit in it. You know, I don't go all the way with Michael Jones, and you know, seeing things in quite that Judeo-centric terms, but I do think there's some truth in that, and we certainly should be allowed to talk about it. What I really object to is the censorship that, you know, people like Jones and other people who are critics of Jewish or Zionist power, like Gilad Atzmon and so many others, get marginalized and shot down. And, you know, you can be a heretic in so many ways, but if you're a heretic against the sacred cows of that one particular group, that's when you're likely to get shut down or even imprisoned. People in Europe are going to prison for doing revisionist historiography, and that's totally unacceptable. So that, I think that's a really important issue with the, you know, preserving the freedom that makes America worth fighting for. Is, you know, if the American people are supposed to go, you know, fight to stay on top of the world, we should be at least fighting for something decent in our own system. And what would that be? Well, our system is based on this ideology of enlightenment freedom that's behind our Constitution. And so if you stage a 9/11 false flag so you can burn the Constitution and we no longer have any freedom, the only difference between us and China really is that China restrains its oligarchs in such a way as to try to promote the common good for ordinary people while the U.S. doesn't. Well, that's a heck of a reason to fight for the U.S. You know? So, it's pathetic what they've done to America. And you know, a lot of what I do, it's not so much that I'm a pissed off Muslim who hates America. I'm a pissed off American.
From the Midwest. From the Midwest.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
that's at the end of the hour. I'm going to have to go have dinner with my.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah. But you do raise a certain point about this. The problem of the West liberal democracy is that it's a dollar democracy, and the problem of money. We can have our constitution that talks about freedom, but how do you deal with the issue of wealth concentration and the inevitability of oligarchy, and without with a weak state or some sort of moral restraint, there's nothing really restraining him. And really, what's right and wrong is determined by who has the power, who has the money. That's the problem we have
here. Yeah, and that's why you need a really strong tradition to refrain that. And that tradition, you know, some would call it, an atheist might call it an ideological tradition. And somebody who thinks Rene Guenon was on the right track, like I do, you know, might call it a religious spiritual tradition. Mm-hmm. Either way, if you have lots and lots and lots of people who deep in their hearts are absolutely convinced that usury is worse than, like, you know, raping their mother, you know, then that culture is going to put some restraints on lending it interest. And likewise, if you have a lot of people who've been taught that, you know, that Marx was right and that these capitalists need to be overthrown and you need to have a communist party guiding the development, blah, 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 that culture is also going to be restraining its oligarchs more. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have a culture that's been, you know, that's been damaged so badly by the criminal wing of its oligarchy and in such a way as to try to set its oligarchs free to do anything they want, to be as criminal as they want to be, which is really what the West and especially the U.S. has become, then, you know, you've got a total mess. So given all of that, I mean, personally, I would be happy to have the United States just get back to its own ideals really enforce those. And the United States could be a great country if it did that. It would be great for me as a Muslim Unitarian. I was born a Unitarian and I'm still a Unitarian theologically. I'm just a Muslim Unitarian, which is the same thing. But anybody would be good for Hindus and Buddhists and Native Americans and atheists. Everybody would be happy here and capable of living together if this country was still living up to its ideals. And it would be capable of restraining its oligarchs by enforcing justice. You know, justice is a pretty universal thing, but I don't see that happening anymore. And so I'm thinking that maybe China and the Islamic world are the places that have the sacred traditions or the ideologies that are capable of restraining these criminal oligarchs.
Yeah, it's the Freemasonic West. It's been corrupted.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, it's normalcy and localism is the way to go, I think, if we return to some sort of original ideal. We could solve these problems at a local level, or at least return politics to a human scale. But I know you have dinner, so I don't want to keep you anymore. So I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's great talking with you. I appreciate your knowledge. You are an unusually knowledgeable interviewer.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So follow your work. You can follow you at Truth Jihad Radio, right?
Yeah, just go to truthjihad.com and you can find most of what I do there. And I'm putting up a lot of stuff at veteranstoday.com and at unz.com, UNZ.com as well.
Great. Okay, well, thank you. I'll post it soon. I'll send you the link. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to it. Thanks.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.